to the second episode of the Media Briefing podcast. I'm the Media Briefing's news editor, Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Esther Kazaya, the digital content executive.
Later this episode, we're going to be hearing from co-founder of The Drum, Diane Young, and asking her the question, when is a magazine company no longer a magazine company?
But we're going to start with a roundup of the top stories from last week. It's not been a great week for print this week. Hearst UK has announced that it's planning to close titles and has posted a £5.4 million loss.
It's shocking that there would be another bad week for print. All you have to do is look at the ABCs to see that circulations are continuing to fall. It's not exactly a shock that that would necessarily take ad revenue with it. Hearst are trying to spin it kind of positively. They're saying that if you leave aside the performance of their joint ventures with Condé Nast UK, that the actual core media business has increased profits slightly, which is according to Chief Executive Anna Jones.
Yeah, but despite this, this isn't stopping them launching another print magazine, and they've teamed up with Airbnb to produce a 32-page biannual magazine. They say this is going to have content written by hosts themselves.
Because obviously this worked really well with Pineapple.
Airbnb's previous magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Hearst CCO Joanna Cole said, what it does, unlike any other magazine out there, is that it taps into the expertise of you guys. Everything in it is sourced from hosts and regular travellers.
And you've had some thoughts this week on people-sourced content, haven't you? It's content sourced from people who actually aren't trained to produce that.
This is in the wake of NewsQuest announcing that they want people to contribute articles to its South London-based sort of news sites. And I wrote an article arguing that basically newspapers and publications need citizen journalists more than citizen journalists need newspapers. In that, you know, we now have this vast array of distribution channels available to us. If we want to write something about for a community, we can go to The Correspondent almost. We can go to Medium. We can put it out ourselves on Facebook, on Twitter. I think that what this year has proven, other than, you know, the fact that people are awful and will vote for that everyone will be chickens voting for Christmas, is that Facebook Live is an incredible distribution tool if it's used effectively. We don't need to publish our stuff to newspaper sites anymore.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that one turns out. South African company Media24 have also announced that they are planning to exit five of their consumer magazines, which includes Top Car, Top Gear, and weekly fashion magazine Grazia.
Yeah, and the company says it's also considering the possible closure of two of its own monthly titles, kind of in line with their strategy to strengthen its position as Africa's leading digital publisher, you know, while continuing to run that successful print media business. It's almost cutting out the fat, as they say.
Yeah. And their CEO said that they're in South Africa, it's just mirroring the international publishing trends. And they use the argument that actually a lot of the content genres are moving online. Like motoring, for example, is actually doing really, really well online.
I can see that. If you look at what's happening in the UK, with particularly what Dennis are doing, we've spoken to Dennis a couple of times, and each time they sort of double down the idea that people are becoming habituated to buying cars online, all the money's going online. So, you know, why not move across the editorial proposition as well? Yeah. It just makes sense.
But generally, there have been all sorts of stories coming out over the last few weeks about print having a tough time. There is one exception. Glossy magazines are proving resilient. You know, we've heard this year that a lot of print titles like Loaded, Zoo, Nuts, all that kind of thing, they've all closed or embarked on other projects.
And very recently, InStyle obviously has gone digital only. Yeah. It's one of those, it's almost a validation of what Lebedev said when the indie went online only, that he saw a lot of other publications were going to follow suit.
Yeah.
Now, it's not all good news if you look at the ABCs. So Cosmopolitan, it's seen a 60% growth in circulation over, you know, year on year. But that's as a result of completely slashing its price to £1 from £3.80. Circulation in total is still lower than it was 10 years ago.
But despite this, the advertisers don't seem to be worried about this at all, because it's quite well known that Vogue's centenary issue in June this year was at 464 pages. It was its sort of biggest ever. And over half of that was advertising.
The perception is that print advertising is incredibly valuable, and particularly for the luxury magazines, because luxury advertisers don't necessarily want to advertise online where there are still issues around viewability, unsafe ad environments, and ad fraud. So really, if you have an incredibly valuable luxury product to sell, you still want to sell it in an environment that you can control, like the print magazines.
And Vogue say, you know, high-end magazines have access to this audience that advertisers are particularly after at the moment, and it's this kind of luxury feel, you know, they talk about the feel of the magazine. So it seems despite print's tough time at the moment. Advertisers are still willing to pay for the pages.
Mm, definitely. But it's not, advertisers aren't just exclusively going after the print market anymore.
No.
So for instance, we've seen that Condé Nast, Britain's 18-person native ad team, accounts for half of its total digital revenue. And, you know, it's been doing native online for years, but it's only had a dedicated 18-person team producing, distributing and selling it for the last 6 months.
Yeah, and they attribute their success there to their 5 data analysts on that team, who give actual metrics back. Perhaps reliable metrics is a subject we're not going to go into.
No, that's its own podcast, I think. That's its own dedicated podcast.
Yeah.
Like, forget interviews and forget the news roundup, so we could just do one on data analysts. And speaking of online ad money, Facebook's ad revenue has finally topped some media giants. It's still, previously, you know, it's like Comcast and Disney in overall advertising revenue, despite all the hype around its digital ad growth. But for the first time this year, the company's US ad revenue will be larger than the biggest traditional media companies.
It's obviously not overtaking Google yet, but it does mean that the two sides are kind of going to be increasingly pitted against each other for brand advertising dollars. This doesn't bode well for everybody else.
No, everything we've heard recently about the fact that the only people who are actually seeing significant digital ad revenue growth are those two media companies. It's arguably a duopoly, and that's not really good for those media companies who are squeezed in the middle. You know, so Facebook CFO noted that the company's substantial growth in revenue, which you mentioned was 56% higher than the last quarter from the previous year, was likely to slow down, and the company would soon max out the volume of ads it can show to people on Facebook.
Yeah, there's only so many adverts you can show. Well, I don't know. There are theoretically only so many adverts you can show people, and it's good in a way that they're recognising that.
Yeah.
But the shares have plummeted this week as a result of that.
Yeah.
But I think just to put this in some context, Facebook has still got a long way to go to catch up to Google's revenue. So far this year, Google have made $21.5 billion in ad revenue. And Facebook in second place are $9.1 billion. So, yeah, they've doubled that easily. There's still quite a lot of catch up.
They're only on $9.1 billion. Like, forget it. I don't get out of bed for less than $9.1 billion. That's crazy. Earlier this week, we spoke to Diane Young, who is the co-founder of The Drum, which is kind of a site for advertising agencies, really. And you were surprised to learn that, in addition to their events and the site, which they're most well known for, that they even have a print product.
I've known about The Drum for absolutely ages, and it wasn't until a talk earlier this year that Diane even mentioned about their magazine. And I thought, well, in terms of the brand, I've known the brand for ages, but I had no idea that this magazine existed. So it's quite an interesting proposition about when does a magazine company stop being a magazine company?
Exactly. So earlier this week, we sat down with her to discuss exactly that.
I think that there's probably, you know, of the vast number of people that come to our website, lots of people don't know. I think actually that's our fault, because we're not actually getting that across properly on our website, and we should be doing that. But of course, we started with print. We're still printing 25 issues a year, plus about 10 supplements. We do 2 or 3 books, and we do a quarterly magazine in the US, so we are very much doing print, and if people don't know that, then we have to make a better job of making sure they find out.
Yeah, it's still a huge operation then at this point. It's not like you're not winding it down or anything.
Well, the print advertising element of our revenue now is small compared to the total, but it's still holding up not too bad against what it was about 5-6 years ago, which is good. And we're printing more pages now than we were in the same time scale. So we were actually re-engineering the business to allow for the fact print advertising would die off, but actually as part of that we managed to maintain it quite well. I think what we're trying to do really with our website is to build audience.
Yeah.
And then to show people what else we've got that they might find useful. If we're not doing that with our magazine on the website, which we're clearly not, because you didn't notice.
Well, I get 2 or 3 of your newsletters as well.
Yeah,
so.
Then that's something we really should be addressing.
In terms of the audience on your website, I know you've said that it's about 40% now is non-UK based in terms of web traffic. How are you tying the print magazine into that? Because The Drum obviously is having an increasingly international focus. How do you see that all kind of fitting together?
Yeah, well, I actually, since you heard that figure from me, it's probably gone up to about 50% of our traffic from outside the UK. And last month, for the first time ever, the traffic was bigger in the USA for 1 or 2 days on the site than it was in the UK. So that's really quite exciting for us to see that development. In terms of the print side of it, we're planning early next year to take the magazine to a global format, so it will be less frequent. It will go to monthly instead of fortnightly, but we are looking to circulate it in Europe, the US and Asia, so that we have that print experience spread out to a wider audience.
And what's driving that decision? Is it just based on sort of what you're hearing from your audience, or is it based on sort of those audience figures?
Well, our aim is to be the first global marketing news platform, and so in terms of the website, that's easy to figure out what to do there, and it's easy to monitor whether it's working or not. We can just see it from our analytics. But you know, we, in terms of the magazine, it's very much UK based at the moment, but as time has gone on and our website has become more international, the content of the UK magazine has actually become less UK based. And eventually it just kind of doesn't seem to make sense. The magazine and the website don't really match each other anymore, so felt it would make sense to align everything to our goal, including the magazine. So.
And this kind of seems to buck a trend in the industry, because everybody's struggling with print, and you see it, and places are shutting all the time. But you guys seem to, well, I mean, you're launching essentially a new print magazine. Mm. So if, would you say there's like some sort of magic ingredient the Drum has that everybody else is missing?
We still love print. We love print, and our audience is made up of a lot of creative people, designers and advertising people who also still like to read something in print, and they love to get a beautifully produced piece of design that appears in print in their post, in their postbox. We also have a lot of digital readers and audience, and we actually are just about to publish a book that's a download of information that we have on one of our websites, the RER. It's called the RER Download, very imaginative. And we put out something to the people that's aimed at, which is brand, people in brands, asking them if they would like to pre-order a copy, and we did get people saying yes, we'd like to, but quite a high proportion of the people who asked for that had digital marketing in their title, and they would say, would you like a printed book, and they're like putting their hands up and saying yes, we would. So I think it's a bit of a generalisation to say that, you know, digital generation don't like print. I think there's still definitely a place for it. So I think the fact that we love it, we think our audience love it, and we're committed to doing it, we believe it brings a brand to life in a way that a website doesn't quite, because it's actually in your hands.
It's almost
in
the
your hands.
Differentiation
yeah.
now. It's,
yeah.
it's almost in the same way that, I mean, we've seen very specific new print launches. I mean, delayed gratifications now and now what? It's sort of well into its life cycle. We've also seen, you know, Future Publishing acquired Imagine with the express purpose of getting hold of their bookazine division. So it does kind of speak to the idea that print has a purpose and a value as long as you are very clear on what it is. But you are so well known for events as well at this point. At what point in the life cycle did the events really start taking off?
Well, actually when I joined, because I joined to start doing events, so we had won awards in Scotland that was outsourced, and although it was our idea and our format and our audience, we didn't actually get any of the commercial benefit from it. We got a tiny slice of the action. So my husband Gordon, who started the business with his friend Nick, asked me if I would join the business to do events, and so I started in the February, and I produced my first advertising awards in October. I dreamed, I had nightmares, literally dreaming of that event for about 6 months, all sorts of terrible dreams about what might go wrong. But people, I mean, we've had, there's children in Scotland who exist because we had Scottish Design Awards.
Oh,
because somebody who was one of the top designers in Scotland at the time went along, he was nominated, and he met somebody who became his wife, they now have children, you know.
Wow.
And something like the Scottish Design Awards, that really helped to create a community when there wasn't one. They didn't get together. They knew each other, but they didn't get together.
I just want to go back to something you said before, which is that you use these, your events almost as a, I guess, like a nucleation point for your community.
Mm.
And sort of it became a sort of focal point where they could all sort of go and interact.
Yeah.
That's an advantage that a lot of media companies don't have.
Mm.
You know, that they are either too general to have a close-knit community around one topic,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, they don't have the ability to put on these events that can act as almost a flashpoint for these communities
mm-hmm.
to come together.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how much of the Drum success do you ascribe to having that community early sort of coalescing around these events?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really, really important. And I think anyone who thinks that they can't do events you know, they can. And secondly, if they think they don't have the tight-knit community, then they can create it. I mean, we've got 23 awards shows across the UK now and one in the US. But all of them are for a particular niche. It's a part of the job that I feel very lucky that I've had the chance to get involved in.
But this was a community that existed sort of prior to the events, just maybe not having the sort of close connections which other those events did. They presumably all came in through the original through the magazine.
So they would have been on our database for something, whether they were subscribers or advertisers. But yeah, that is also, you know, if you do events, it's a really great way to grow your database as well. Because some people might never want to read your magazine or your website, but they want to come along and be involved in live events.
They
want to
hold
their
gong.
Thing.
They want to hold the gong statue.
Yeah, I mean, the likelihood is they're not, because of course we publish the results in the magazine and online afterwards, so they want to go and look at themselves.
Of course,
you know, having that. So it's highly unlikely they would be only involved there. But you know, if somebody buys a table and they invite along a guest who's never heard of the drum, suddenly, you know, you've got a new person in the room who's in your circle.
Absolutely. I think it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that they are very complementary products. You know, they have, even to the extent that people will then go and check the results in a print product, even though, you know, if they were there at the events, they like to see their name there.
Yeah.
And so you've launched other services as well that presumably all tie into this sort of central editorial theme.
Yes.
So to what extent is the print product still involved in almost directing that editorial sort of direction? Are they all an extension of this overarching strategy?
What we've done is to look at what we think we can do to help our audience. So it could be summed up, I suppose, as we want them to learn stuff, be able to learn stuff, we want them to keep up to date, we want them to be able to compete, we want them to be able to recruit. So we look at it more in terms of what do we think businesses need and which services can we provide to help them do that.
So the question that our editor Peter posed almost when we were pitching this the interview was, when is a magazine publisher no longer a magazine publisher?
That is a really good question, actually, because when I go out and about, people say, "Well, what do? I actually find it quite hard to describe now.
Yeah.
So it used to be we were a publisher, and then we were publishing an event, and now we're so many different things that it's very difficult to describe. So I'd say something like, you know, we're a media business serving marketing and media people.
Through that suite of products that just happens to include a magazine now.
It happens to include a magazine. The magazine is at the centre of it all. It's the heart, the beating heart of the body. But we've got lots of other arms and legs of
long limbs.
So are we a publishing company or a magazine company? Not really.
Yeah.
Not anymore. But we do those things amongst other.
Well, I mean, everyone's talking about transition. It's the buzzword, and it has been. I think it will be for the next couple of years at least.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's almost a proof point for that. You know, that you can transition from one thing to the other, but still maintain that sort of core, as you said, the beating heart.
Yeah.
It's something that I think a lot of other media companies, almost not necessarily publishers, as you said, would like to emulate.
So yeah, we made a lot of mistakes along the way, and we're probably still making some, but we're trying to use what we've learned to make sure that if we are making mistakes, we sort them quicker. I worry about these sort of I don't want to call them trends, I'd call them fads, where media owners are kind of romanced into all sort of chasing after the new thing. It makes me think of like when you watch little boys playing football, you know, they're all like within 3 feet of the ball and the rest of the pitch is empty because they're all chasing that ball.
Have you got anything you'd say as a fad at the moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, in a way, because you want to have all sorts of different channels, but it's well nigh impossible without a cast of thousands to maintain them all, to market them all, to make sure that they're all returning your investment. I was in Asia at a conference, a media conference, and all about messaging apps.
Yeah.
So there was lots of people saying, oh, this is what we do, this is what it looks like, this is how many followers we've got. And there was some feedback about, you know, how many links through to website they got. There was a lot of talk about people aren't going to be going to your website anymore, they're going to just be doing this, but there was nobody talking about how they monetized it.
Mm.
Nobody.
Yeah.
And I was watching all the audience scribbling down and obviously thinking, well, we must be getting messaging apps, we must be on this. And I was just thinking, you're going to need another team of people, and there's no indication how you actually make money out of it. Or maybe they just weren't saying.
Yeah.
But so I worry about that kind of thing, because you do feel obliged to make sure that you're covering all these new channels. And then of course there's all the tech that goes around,
mm-hmm.
All the tech that's made for publishers now, and you're wondering which ones you should, which ones you actually need, and which ones you just need to feel that you need. I think we're lucky that, I wouldn't like to be in publishing and be in B2C now. I mean, I've never been in B2C, so maybe I just don't understand it, but I think we're lucky to be in B2B because you can identify the niches, and it's easier to get to the audience in a way, and to provide other things to them. I mean, some consumer magazines have done, you know, amazing things like Clothes Show Live and all those kinds of things that we see in the, you know, in the event categories of the awards. But I think it's easier for B2B publishers. And we've just been thinking about it for a long time. And I think it's part of our DNA, because we came from somewhere where it was really hard to flourish as a publishing company, that we had no choice. We didn't have massive, big DPS sales to, you know, big brands. We had to scrap for everything. So I suppose people do say that necessity is the mother of invention, and I think perhaps the drum is the embodiment of that.
Fantastic. So what was the last book you read that really sort of affected you?
I am currently reading a book called The Membership Economy. I'm finding that really interesting because I think that membership is something that all publishers should be looking at. How can you turn someone into a one-off customer, from a one-off customer or a reader into somebody who's part of you, who's a member of your club and who wants to engage in you in that kind of way. So I'm finding that really interesting and really helpful in terms of looking at different models, like how Netflix did it, how your payment options work.
It's kind of inspiring loyalty, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think that's a really important model for publishers, so I'm enjoying that. And I just finished reading The Death of Bees, which is a very quirky little book set in Maryhill in Glasgow, which I thoroughly enjoyed reading.
Our State of the Media 2017 report launched last month, and it's gone really, really well. If you want to get your copy, you can go to our website, themediabriefing.com.
You can also sign up to our daily email. It contains an essential daily briefing, plus our most read stories from around the media industry. We're also aiming to deliver this podcast weekly, so stay tuned.
Registration is also now open for Digital Media Strategies 2017. That takes place from the 20th to the 23rd of February next year in London. And this is kind of our key event for addressing a lot of the big picture challenges facing the industry. If you want to go and register for that, digital-media-strategies.com.
We're also launching our first Digital Media Strategies webinar, in which Sumant Bhatia will be exploring how to come up with the ultimate video. And that's an incredibly broad title, but when you think about how central video is going to be to publishers' strategies over the next couple of years, you kind of do have to pitch it that broad, I think.
Yeah.
So from treatment and format to distribution and revenue models, there's a lot
very
of variables.
Important.
Yeah. When it comes to making videos that resonate with audience and provide value for the publishers. That's going to take place on Thursday, the 1st of December at 3 p.m. You can sign up at digital-media-strategies.com/webinar.
And finally, this podcast is made for you. So if you've got anything you want to hear us talk about or things you particularly like or dislike, get in touch.
You can find me on Twitter at Chris M. Sutcliffe.
And I'm on Twitter at Esther Keziah H.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.